So what is ecology? Right. Ecology is all about interactions between organisms and their environment. So ecology as a whole science includes all of those interactions. Tonight we're just going to focus on interactions between species, which is just part of ecology, of course. It's an important part. Another way you could say that either as species-species interactions or as interspecific, which means the same thing between species. And we see an example of a interspecific interaction in the opening slide. As usual, this is just kind of an interesting example. In case you don't see both organisms, I'm sure you see the sea urchin in red. There's a crab underneath it. And a lot of people would guess, well, you have one creature trying to attack or eat the other. That's not what's happening here. The sea urchin actually isn't doing anything to the crab. The crab is actually using the sea urchin. The sea urchin is well protected, by the way, by itself, right? Because of its spines. And the crab is taking advantage of the fact that those spines are such good protection for the sea urchin by using the sea urchin as a spiny shield for itself, basically. So the crab positions itself under the sea urchin, gets it on its back, and then anything that comes by and tries to eat the crab, it will just point the sea urchin at it, basically. So this brings up a fundamental question about interspecific interactions in general, which is, how does this affect the two species involved? You can ask that about any interaction between species. That's an important question that has different answers depending on the situations. So in slide 2, let's look at different kinds of interspecific interactions on this table. Notice that the kinds of interactions are labeled in the first column, but next to the name of that kind of interaction in each of those cases is some symbology. Pluses, minuses, or zeros. That's just shorthand for answering the question I was just asking. A plus indicates that a species is helped somehow. A minus is that it's harmed, but by harm I don't necessarily mean injured. That certainly is an example of harm. But by harm, I just mean in general, it is bad somehow for that species. It could just be that it wastes its energy or reduces its fitness somehow. It's kind of just a general detriment to the species. And then the couple that have zeros, those zeros indicate neutrality. The species isn't helped, it's not harmed. Okay, so let's go through these and talk about the differences. Notice, speaking of those symbols, that the first one on the list, competition, well, you tell me what you notice. What is special about that? It's the only one that's double negative, yes. In other words, competition is the only interspecific interaction that is harmful to both species involved. All the others involve benefit to at least one of the species involved. And competition is just basically what you probably already expected it to be based on the word. Two different species are competing for something that they both want. And that something can be just about anything. It's not necessarily food, but food is a good example. It could be sunlight. Any resource, anything that the species want or need can be competed for. And so it's pretty common sense why this is detrimental to both, right? Not only does it not allow one species to have all of that resource, but it also can lead to actual injury in the case of animals competing, for instance, right? If they're competing, they can actually hurt each other. Predation is next. And that refers to one organism eating another, or one species, I should say, eating another. Now, predation is not the only case of one species eating another, but it specifically refers to one species killing another species in the process of eating it. Either killing it before it eats it, or it dies because of how it eats it. And so this is usually used for animals eating other animals. There are some exceptions to that, but that's usually what we talk about when it's predation. That's very clearly a plus minus, right? Well, I mean, it should very clearly be a minus for the one. The prey species is the one that dies and gets eaten. So that's clearly bad for fitness when you die. You're not going to pass on your genes. And also, it's clearly a plus for the predator, the one that eats it, because he's getting energy, or he or she. Herbivory is next. And this is one of many words that end in that ivory suffix, which means to eat, right? Carnivore or carnivory, for instance, is flesh-eating. There's herbivory, which is eating vegetation, and so on. So this is another example of one species eating another species. But what's distinct about herbivory is not only what's being eaten. A plant or an alga is being eaten in herbivory. That is one difference rather than an animal, but really more importantly, it's ecologically different because in most cases of herbivory, the thing being eaten is not killed. Right? You can go to eat a chunk of a plant and it's not necessarily going to kill that plant. It's certainly going to be detrimental to it though if you eat just part of it even, which is why this is also clearly a plus minus. And then next in the list is symbiosis, which notice doesn't have any symbol. And that's because symbiosis is a category. It's not just one kind of interaction. And that's why the next few under that are indented. All these three are examples of symbiosis. They are all symbioses, which is the plural. We've talked about symbiosis before, right? Several times we've had examples. The word literally means the condition of living together. So symbiosis is simply an interaction in which the two species have a very close living arrangement. But notice just saying that doesn't at all say anything about how they're affected, either positively, negatively, or neutrally. That's why there are different kinds of symbioses depending on what the effects are. So all of the examples of symbiosis that we've looked at, like the headlight fish and so on, have been specifically mutualism because it has benefited both species involved. That's why mutualism is plus plus. They have a mutual benefit. They're both benefited. That's not the only kind of symbiosis, though. Parasitism is plus minus because the parasite benefits. The parasite is something that lives in or on the host, the other one that gets the detriment. It's the one that's harmed in some cases. In some way. So that's the minus. And the only other kind of symbiosis is plus zero, which is commensalism. Now, plus zero is kind of a lie because there's probably no such thing in reality of an actual zero, no effect at all. But if it's pretty close, if you can't even tell, like if you're trying to make measurements, and you can't even tell whether something is benefited or harmed, then you call it a zero. But even that is comparatively rare. Compared to parasitism and mutualism, commensalism is harder to find real examples of. But that's also a symbiosis. All right, facilitation is after that. That's not symbiosis. Notice that it's no longer indented. That's a totally different kind of interaction. And in facilitation as a word, of course, means helping out, right? And that's what's happening in a facilitation. One species, by doing something how it lives, is helping another species to exist wherever that is. And this, not always, but typically involves a plant species as the facilitator, the one that's helping. Now, of course, it's not intentionally helping. It's just by its mode of life it is helping. It typically involves a plant species that, because it's there, something about its living actually makes the environment livable for something else. Notice also that facilitation is dually listed as either plus plus or zero plus. Now, zero plus is not the same as plus zero. It's listed as zero plus because in some cases the facilitator is not affected. That's the first one. Facilitation always helps the other one, right? That's why it's called facilitation. So that's why it's plus on the second one in all cases. In some cases, the facilitator itself actually ends up being helped by the things that it allows to live there that it has already helped. So it just depends on the situation. Okay, now to three. The cartoon picture on this slide represents a community. Or actually, I guess it represents an ecosystem. What's the difference between those two? Difference between a community and an ecosystem. That's right. And what is an ecosystem? Not really, no. That's right. The community is all of the populations, so all of the living things, and that's it. The ecosystem is the same place. It includes the entire community, but it also includes all the non-living stuff. Air and water and etc., the rocks. So this is an ecosystem. And like any ecosystem, there are many different kinds of organisms living there. We're going to ignore most of them, including the trees and stuff. What we really care about, just to give a definition, are the several different species of lizard living here, all of which are members of the same genus, by the way, which is why they all have in their scientific name A, which is they're all member of the same genus. Remember, a scientific name is genus and species. So they're all different species, but they're highly related. And the placement of their scientific names at different places in the ecosystem represents the fact that they live in separate spaces. Now, separate actual spaces, meaning locations, is an important part of what I'm about to define, but it's not the only thing. What we say is that these different species occupy different niches. Or if you prefer niche, it can be pronounced either way, niche or niche. But what is a niche? Well, a niche is more than just an actual location. That is an important part of it. Niche is an ecological word that means the set of resources that a species uses within an ecosystem. And location is part of that. You know, where something lives is part of the set of resources that it uses. But also so is the type of sunlight, or how much sunlight it gets, how much water it uses, and so on. So, obviously there's going to be an overlap, right? Species use some resources, you know, in common. But if you look at the entire list of resources that one species uses, it won't be exactly the same list as another species. And that's why we say they occupy different niches. Now, why is it that different species occupy different or separate niches within an ecosystem? Why does it work out that way? It's not just by chance. I mean, it could be that two species occupy exactly the same niche. But why doesn't that happen? Or why isn't it allowed to continue to happen? Because it would lead to competition, right? If you're trying to occupy exactly the same set of resources that another species is, that means you're going to be competing all the time. And what did we say about competition? It's bad for both of the involved species. And therefore, natural selection disfavors occupying the same niche, right? Because what benefits the species in the long run is to occupy your own niche to minimize the occurrence of competition. Yeah.
What did you say the niche was?
Niche is the set of all resources that an individual species uses within an ecosystem. One of which is space, location, but it's everything else as well that it's using. Okay, let's go on to 4. Now we just defined niche. Here we can see that there are two subdivisions of that, definition-wise. There is what we call a realized niche and a fundamental niche. And it's possible for them to be the same thing, but not necessarily. A fundamental niche is a niche that a species would occupy if there weren't anything keeping it from occupying it. A realized niche, on the other hand, is the actual niche that it is occupying. And that's why I said they could be the same, but in general they're not. The fundamental niche is at least as big as the realized niche. It could be bigger, right? If it's bigger, that means the species would occupy a bigger niche than it actually is, but something is presumably preventing it from filling that entire fundamental niche. And we can see that experimentally here. This is the results of an actual experiment in a place where you find two different species of barnacles, represented in cartoon form here by the brown and the blue species. Now, where they occur together, in the same location, basically, they are not intermixed, right? So they are occupying separate niches. You find the brown ones higher up and the blue ones lower down, as you see here, for exactly the reason I just said, right? That they're occupying separate niches to minimize competition. But the experimental question here is the brown barnacle occupying its fundamental niche? In other words, is it as spread out as it would be if there's nothing preventing it? Which is the realized niche, the niche it's actually occupying naturally, as big as the fundamental niche? And to experimentally answer that, they just took away the blue ones, and not everyone in the world, of course, but just in this one area, removed the blue ones and waited, and then went back and did more measurements. And when they removed the blue ones, the brown ones did indeed spread out. So in this case, the fundamental niche is bigger than the realized niche, and presumably this is because competition has been reduced. All right, now to slide 5. We're back to looking at these Galapagos finches, which we've looked at several times. Here we have three different islands. They're listed in the graphs. The names of the islands are shown in the graphs. But these three islands are important. I mean, they're different in an important way, different from each other. In the top graph, that island features only one of these two bird species. Now, of course, there's all kinds of other species, but of these two listed bird species, which once again, they're from the same genus but different species, this first island has only the species on the left. The middle graph, that's for an island that has only the one on the right and not the left. And then the third one features both of them. All right. Now, these are pretty stout-billed species, as you can see in the pictures. They have really powerful beaks, which means it shouldn't be surprising that they are seed crackers, because they have the power to do that. But anyway, if you make measurements of their beak depth for the ones that live by themselves, in a sense, on this island, and then the other one by itself, notice that the mean beak depth is about the same on these two different islands for these two different species. But in the island in which they occur together, they're the same two species, but now they're living together. Notice that one has a much smaller bill than the other. And so what explains this? Well, why would the bill sizes be different to begin with? Because they're eating different things, right? Natural selection has favored the bill size that's appropriate for their diet. And the bigger one is cracking harder seeds. The other one's eating easier to eat stuff, the smaller ones. But the question is, why would it come to be that way? Why wouldn't they have the same beak size as the same species that lives on the other island by itself? Right, the avoidance of competition. So what's happened here is over generations, the two different species that live together are starting to specialize on their own kind of diet in order not to actually interfere or compete with the other species. And natural selection has favored a bill size that's appropriate for their individual diets. So it once again points out the importance of competition, or the importance of the avoidance of competition. Okay, now to six. Here we'll talk about some coloration patterns that we find on animals. And this is, at the top, A and B, kind of two opposites, two extremes that are opposite of each other. Upper left, we have cryptic coloration. Cryptic means hard to discover, right? Like a cryptic code is hard to break. Well, if you're just glancing at this, you might not even see the frog in there because it is so well camouflaged. And certainly, if you were just walking by, you probably would never know it's there. That's really impressive camouflage. Now, that's pretty easy to understand why that would evolve, right? If it's well hidden, it is not nearly going to be as likely for it to be discovered by a predator that wants to eat it. And natural selection is going to easily operate on that, right? Because if you don't get eaten, then you live long enough to pass on your genes that gave you that cryptic coloration, and it gets better and better over the generations. What about the aposematic coloration in the upper right, which is not very good camouflage at all? Here you have a frog that is black, orange, and blue. And you're going to be hard-pressed to find a place in nature that is black, orange, and blue that is going to nicely blend in against, right? In other words, it's almost gaudily, intentionally trying to stand out and be seen instead of hiding. which doesn't seem to make sense, right? Because it's going to make it obvious to predators that that frog is there. That would be maladaptive if it weren't for the case that this is a poisonous frog. And the idea here is that if you are a poison-producing frog, it's good to get the word out that you're poisonous. So aposematic coloration is obvious because it's, in effect, an advertisement. Yes, here I am, but you have probably learned from other ones like me that I'm not something you want to eat. And so by standing out and advertising their harmfulness, they actually are protected. Okay, on the bottom, both of the left and right, we have different kinds of mimicry. Mimicry means imitating, right? So there's Batesian mimicry and Müllerian mimicry, and they differ in an important way. In Batesian mimicry, on the lower left, you have one species that is harmful and another species that's harmless, and the harmless species has come to look very much like the harmful species. And the idea makes good sense, right? If you have something that you know is harmful and you try to look like it, everyone else is going to think you're also harmful. Right? So the example shown here is pretty interesting. You have a venomous green parrot snake. That's this one. It's the truly dangerous one. It's venomous, right? No one wants to mess with it. The one that's brown, the coloration's not all that perfect, but it looks very much similar. That's not even a snake. In fact, this isn't even a head, and these aren't even eyes. This is just one end of not even a reptile, let alone a snake. This is a caterpillar. Completely harmless caterpillar. Can't do any damage to something. It's a sitting duck for anything that wants to eat it. But some of them get away with this because it looks enough like the harmful snake. And not only just looks like it, it also moves just like it, and it even makes a hiss that makes it sound like it. So things are fooled. And all you have to do is live long enough until you turn into the adult insect that the caterpillar will eventually turn into, and you're saved. So that makes good sense why a harmless species would want to mimic a harmful one. Müllerian mimicry is a little different. Here, the two species, or it could be more than two, could be multiple different species, come to look very similar to each other, but they're all harmful in one way. Either harmful, like stingers or whatever, or unpalatable, meaning that they just taste terrible. So once again, the idea here is similar to aposematic coloration. It's get the word out that anything that looks like this, with these common banding patterns that different species have, that all kind of co-evolves as a universal advertisement of something you don't want to mess with. Okay. Well, let's look at some examples of these interactions that we had on the table. Which one are we looking at here in 7? What kind of interaction? Yeah, this is herbivory. So the manatee is eating the vegetation. That's not necessarily killing this whole plant, right? But it's still a plus-minus interaction, obviously, because the plant would rather not be eaten any of it. What about 8? Here we have the two species involved are the acacia tree, and as you see in the close-up, ants that live on it. How would you, what kind would you say this is? What kind of interaction? Well, that's a good guess, but actually it is, well, commensalism, remember, is one type of symbiosis, first of all. This is a symbiosis, but it's actually mutualism. Yet another example of mutualism, like all the others we've had so far. Because it benefits both. I can see that. I assume that by commensalism you were probably thinking the ants benefit and the tree is neutral. That's good. It's reasonable to think so, but actually the tree benefits as well. In the close-up, you can see that the tree produces these little hollow bag-like structures that give reward to the ants. That's clearly how the ants benefit, right? The reason that it's mutualism, though, and the reason that the plant also benefits and is willing to give up this sweet reward as food to the ants is that the ants are so appreciative that they destroy anything that comes near the plant. This acacia tree is not just in a place that happened to be bare. This bare spot around it is because any animal that tries to come by will get stung like hell by the ants. And any small plant that starts growing will just be destroyed immediately. So these ants are saying, I don't want anything around this thing that feeds me, and therefore the plant benefits as well, because there's no, you know, it's in its own little batch of sunlight because nothing can grow around it. Okay, 9. This one might be commensalism. And I say might because of what I said before. Commensalism is really the hardest one to say. Definitely there's commensalism because it's so hard to say. Definitely it's neutral for one of them. But it probably is close to commensalism. We're not talking about the plants here. We're talking about the two animals. So the buffalo and the birds are the two species that we care about here. Which one is benefiting? The birds are clearly benefiting. Why is it that they're benefiting, or how do they benefit? Why? Well, no, that's actually, they can get around pretty well. They can fly, after all. Did you just guess birds? Why is it that the birds are benefiting? Birds are trying to eat, right? And they eat insects, among other things, but they largely eat insects. There's plenty of insects in this grassy field. But it takes energy to go foraging for insects, right? The more energy you spend on getting food, the less actual energy you end up taking in as a net, because you'd waste some of it looking for them. Well, this huge lumbering buffalo, as it just walks around, is causing a bunch of insects to just jump out of the way. And so they become a lot easier to find if the egrets stay right next to the thing that's scaring all these insects out. They can easily pick them then, and they don't spend nearly as much energy finding them. So that's definitely a benefit for the egrets. What about the buffalo? Well, like I said, it's close to commensalism because, I mean, I guess you could say maybe it's helped because they're definitely going to be eating some insects off of the buffalo's back as well, which could be a benefit. On the other hand, the buffalo could just be annoyed by the fact that there's birds always jumping on it. Who knows? But it's not a very big benefit or a very big detriment either way, so we lump it in as commensalism. 10 is an example of the last one that was listed in the table, which is facilitation, which, remember I said, usually involves some plant as a facilitator, allowing other things to live there after the plant is established. And in this case, it's a salt marsh where the facilitator starts to grow. A salt marsh, as the name implies, is a salty place. What's the problem with salty soil? Tonicity, exactly. A salty soil solution is a hypertonic environment, right? Which, by osmosis, that's going to cause water to leave the cell, dehydrate it. So a lot of things can't grow if it gets too salty. Well, if you have a salt-tolerant species start living there first, they are then going to shade the area because of their foliage. And if you shade the soil, it's no longer getting as much direct sunlight. It's therefore no longer heating up as much, and therefore not as much evaporation is occurring from the soil, right? Well, if you don't stop that evaporation, what happens to the saltiness? It gets increasingly bad, right? Because when you evaporate, it's only the water, not the salt, that leaves. Just like if you forget that you're boiling salt water, come back hours later, it'll be a dry pan with just salt on the bottom, no water. So if you prevent that evaporation, then you're keeping the soil from becoming as salty as it would without that plant, and therefore other things might be able to start growing there as well. Facilitation. You can see that in the graph. Number of plant species is much higher when you have the facilitator present than if you don't. Okay, now let's switch gears a little bit in slide 11 and talk about biodiversity, something we'll talk beyond this chapter about, but biodiversity is really important part of ecology, an important concern in ecology. It obviously involves diversity of life, right? That's what the word literally means. But what we see explained in these cartoons is that there are two important components of biodiversity. So biodiversity is not just a single thing. There are two parts to it. And those two parts are species richness and relative abundance. Now, species richness refers simply to how many different species live in that given area, whatever you're studying. Okay? The higher the species richness, the greater the number of different species live there. And that's all it's referring to. Well, obviously, that's part of biodiversity, right? The number of different species that live there. But it's not the only important thing. The other part of biodiversity is relative abundance. Species richness says only how many species live there. It doesn't tell you anything about how many individuals of each species there are. Relative abundance, on the other hand, cares about how many individuals of each species there are. So to clarify this, if you don't already understand it based on what I've said, let's look at these two communities. And their communities obviously include plants, animals, protists, a bunch of different things. But all we care about here are the plants that we see, and specifically four species of plants, A, B, C, and D. We'll notice that in community one, there's four plants. Community two, there's four plants. So in terms of species richness, these communities are identical. They both have exactly four species. But in terms of relative abundance, they are not. Because in community one, there's just as many A's, B's, C's as D. Whereas in community two, it's dominated by species A. And there are many fewer individuals of B, C, and especially D, as you see. So the relative abundance, which is how many there are of each species compared to the other species, is not equal in the two communities. And therefore, the biodiversity overall is not equal in these two. The biodiversity overall is higher in community one. And biodiversity is really important to the continued health of the community or the ecosystem. So that's one thing that we really pay attention to when we study communities or ecosystems is biodiversity overall. Because when it starts to go down, it becomes a snowball effect or a domino effect. That's why we need to be so concerned with the fact that there's so much more extinction that's happening now, caused by us. Because the more that happens, the more extinctions of yet other things is going to happen, and the overall biodiversity is going to topple. Well, in slide 12, we're looking at a place that's an outdoor research station to test these sorts of things. So you can see the patchwork here. Each one of these squares is its own little test area, really. Its own replicate in a huge experiment. Each one of these is like a different experimental subject. But each one of them is its own ecosystem. And what makes this experimental rather than just a natural place is that we can manipulate the biodiversity in each of these. So we can intentionally remove certain species, bringing down the biodiversity, and then just see what effect that has. And real data from places like this bear out what I've just said, that as biodiversity goes down, the overall health of the things that do live there still goes down. Okay, in 13, there are a couple examples in cartoon form on the right of what we call food chains. And I'm sure you've heard the phrase food chain before. It's called a chain because, like a real chain, it's made of multiple links that are connected together, right? By the way, these two examples, one of them is terrestrial. That's the one on the left. And the one on the right is a marine food chain. But unlike a real chain, in which case the links are really indistinguishable from each other, there's an order to a food chain. And at the bottom or the base of any food chain, there has to be a producer. Remember that in ecology, there's two fundamentally different categories of organisms, producers and consumers. Now, what is the other name for producers? Autotrophs. And the other name for consumers is heterotrophs. So there has to be a producer at the base, because producers are able to do something very important that no consumer is able to do. What is that? Yes, they do produce their own food. That's what makes them literally called an autotroph. That means self-feeder. But chemically speaking, what is it that producers are able to do that consumers can't, that results in production of food? Well, usually it's sunlight, and it's not always. That's one type of synthesis, right? Photosynthesis, there can also be chemosynthesis. Both of those occur in producers only. But still, what the sunlight is just the source of energy that allows for the chemical process I'm talking about. But what is it chemically that's happening in photosynthesis that can't happen in any consumer? Right, and what do we know about CO2 in terms of chemistry? What kind of compound is that? Inorganic. Even though it contains carbon. Remember, certain carbon-containing compounds are considered inorganic. And so that's what I'm talking about. The chemical process of using an inorganic carbon source and incorporating that into an organic compound, what is that called? That's called carbon fixation. And only producers can do that. Consumers are classified as consumers because they have to have their carbon, which all organisms require, already in organic form. They can't use inorganic carbon and convert that into an organic form. That's why they absolutely rely on the producers of the world, because the producers are the only ones that can make organic compounds to begin with. So, that's why producers are at the base of any food chain. The next link up is a consumer. But notice from the boxes here that there are different classifications of consumers. There are primary, secondary, tertiary. That just means first, second, and third, right? A primary consumer obviously is a consumer, but it is specifically a consumer that directly eats a producer. Simple to understand. Obviously, a primary consumer relies on producer because without it, it doesn't have any food. A secondary consumer is a consumer that eats primary consumers. And even if it never eats a producer, it's still, that secondary producer is still as reliant on the producer as the primary consumer, right? Because a secondary consumer you can think of as a something that eats a producer. And a tertiary consumer is something that eats something that eats something that eats a producer. So it always gets back to a producer, right? That's why they're at the base. Now, there are four levels listed here: primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary. You might not even have four in some ecosystems. But you might think, well, you can go on forever. Fifth level, sixth level, seventh level, whatever. Actually, that's not true. It's limited, and usually is quaternary is about as far as you get. I'll explain why. I think that's a different chapter, but keep that in mind for later. Well, food chains are easy to understand and they're easy to draw, but they don't really reflect reality because most consumers don't eat just a single thing, right? They have a variety of things that they eat. And so food chains are not really realistic. What we really have, as shown in slide 14, is something called a food web, which is really kind of like many food chains all interlinked, just like the individual strands of a spider web, right? That's more reflective of reality. Still, though, just like a food chain, which is just simple form, you have to have, at the base, producers. Plankton, by the way, that you see here, is kind of a general word. Plankton is just organisms that are so small that they basically just float in water. The movement of the water just keeps them near the surface. But there are phytoplankton. What does phyto mean? Or phyte, P-H-Y-T-E. What is an epiphyte? Plant that lives on another plant, exactly. Phyte means plant. So phytoplankton, even though they are not plants, it's kind of a misnomer, get their name because some plankton are the producers. They are photosynthetic. Remember, plants aren't the only photosynthetic organisms. Phytoplankton include cyanobacteria, for instance, which aren't even eukaryotes, let alone plants. But they're called phyto simply because plants also are producers. By comparison, they name them that. On the other hand, you also have carnivorous plankton, which can also be called zooplankton. What does ZO mean? As a combining form, means animal, which is why a place that has animals is a zoo, right? And zoology is the study of animals. Well, zooplankton also aren't necessarily animals, but they use that word because they're plankton that are consumers rather than producers. All right, so you have carnivorous plankton that eat phytoplankton, and then so the carnivorous plankton would be the primary consumers. Then you have consumers that eat the carnivorous plankton. Those are secondary and so on. But it's web-like more than just like a chain. Notice, by the way, that at the very top of that, You have humans. In any given ecosystem, you have the highest level consumer at the top. Humans are high level consumers, and that is a very precarious or dangerous position to hold. Because if you're at the top, that means you rely on everything below you. And therefore, if there's any disturbance, you are going to be most easily toppled. That's another reason why we should be concerned with extinction, because we are the easiest things, among the easiest things to go extinct if there starts to be a toppling. Okay, now for the next few slides, I need to show you some examples of some definitions I'm going to give you of some special species, not actual individual species, but special categories of species, ecologically special, that is. The first one, actually, I don't have a picture for, so I'm not really at 15 yet. But the first category is dominant species. Any given community or ecosystem has a dominant species. And by dominance, that simply means there's more individuals of that species than anything else. So it doesn't say anything good or bad about it. It's simply the dominant species. Okay? Easy to imagine. Next, now we are on slide 15. You have what is called a keystone species. Now, what is a keystone outside of biology? Just in everyday language, what is a keystone? No one from Pennsylvania? The Keystone State? Yeah, it's, or if you talk about keystoning in photography or something, it makes it shaped like this, right? A keystone, yeah, the word comes from masonry. The keystone, the most important stone in the arch, is the one that's kind of wedge-shaped right in the middle. It's the most important because if something happens to that, the whole arch crumbles. So keystone is a word that means something that's pretty important. And a keystone species, something about how it lives, is very important to the overall ecosystem. Usually, the keystone species is not, or a keystone species, I should say, is not the dominant species. And that's true of the example shown here. The sea star here is the keystone species. There aren't all that many of them living in this area, so they're not dominant. But they're particularly important to the health of the rest of the organisms because they keep the oyster population or the seashell population from getting out of control. What you see in the graph is that without the sea star, the number of species present, which is the biodiversity, drops precipitously. The red trace, this very low number of other species present, that's bad news, right? And that's simply because the species of mollusk that this thing eats just gets out of control and outcompetes everything else. But since it specializes in eating that kind, and a sea star can control the population, when the sea star is there, everything else benefits because they're kept in check, basically. So that's a keystone species. 16 is another example of a different definition, which is ecosystem engineer. Kind of a misnomer because engineering implies that there's intentional design. That's actually not what's happening here. But an ecosystem engineer is an organism, or a species, I should say, that fundamentally changes the geography of the ecosystem somehow. Remember, ecosystem refers to more than just the community. It's the non-living stuff as well. And a beaver is a perfect example of this.
Fundamentally changes the
the physical makeup of the ecosystem, the geography. Beavers are a perfect example of this because they build dams, right? Now, they don't care at all about what's happening to the other species. They're just building dams because that's what they use for mating and living in, right? But when they build a dam, that's actually changing the ecosystem, right? It's changing the river. It's making what was kind of one ecosystem in terms of how the water's running into two different ecosystems, right? Because you have the dammed part, which is still in deep water, and the downstream of the dam, you have more rapid running and totally different places to live, right? So that fundamentally changes the lives of all the other species living in this area. Ecosystem engineer. Okay, switch gears again in slide 17. Now let's talk about disturbance. The graph that we're looking at, notice, is plotting number of taxa, groups of organisms. So this is another way of saying biodiversity on the y-axis, versus index of disturbance intensity. But that brings up the question of what a disturbance is. Well, you can probably guess what a disturbance is. It can be just about anything, but a disturbance is something out of the ordinary that's happening that causes life to be different in the ecosystem all of a sudden. Now, you can have mild disturbances and very strong disturbances, like a rain shower today is a disturbance. A storm is a stronger disturbance. Tornado, even stronger, right? Fires are disturbances. I'm sure you can think of other examples. So you can also, in other words, what I'm saying here is that there are different intensities of disturbance, but there's also different frequencies of disturbance. There are some places that get disturbed all the time. That's a high frequency of disturbance. And others which go for long stretches, nothing really happens, and then there's a disturbance all of a sudden. But the point here is that this graph, well, the ecological question, I guess, is obviously disturbance affects things, so the question is how does it affect them? What is the overall effect on an ecosystem? Well, there's a hypothesis that this graph, which are real data, is trying to support. The hypothesis is called the intermediate disturbance hypothesis. And it's called that because it says that biodiversity is maximized when there is an intermediate level of disturbance, which you can see on the graph. Biodiversity is the y-axis. There's lower biodiversity when there is low disturbance, and there's low biodiversity when there's high disturbance. It's highest biodiversity, that is, somewhere in the middle, intermediate disturbance. Well, it's really easy to understand why a very intense disturbance or very frequent disturbance would bring biodiversity down, right? You have a fire every other day, things are going to die off. So that the right side of the graph is pretty easy to understand, right? Too much disturbance is going to be too bad for things to live there. But you might think the lower the disturbance you have, the better it is for biodiversity. So you might think that this would be just a downward line, and it would be highest on the left edge. But that's actually not what happens, and that's not what the hypothesis says. The problem with too little disturbance, either disturbance is not strong enough or it's not frequent enough, is basically that the occupants of that ecosystem get a little too comfortable and too successful. Now remember, all the different species, each of them is operating, is occupying its own niche, right? And if things are going too well because there's never any disturbance, then those niches are all filled. having a little bit of disturbance now and then disrupts that and puts things out of their niches, opens up niches so that other things can come in there and live as well. And so that's why you have greater biodiversity at some intermediate level of disturbance. Well, speaking of disturbance, in slide 18, we're looking at two pictures right after a disturbance on the left. This is in Yellowstone. You probably don't remember it because it was long enough ago that you were probably just being conceived, but there was a hell of a fire in Yellowstone that was big news that I remember. Anyway, this is 1 year after the fire. Obviously, it's a big change. The point here is not the specific example. It's that when you have major disturbances, like a fire, for instance, that's not the only kind of major disturbance. Earthquakes are big. In any case, when you have major disturbances, it's obviously going to take a while for the ecosystem to recover, if it ever does. And that recovery process happens in stages. And we call it, therefore, succession. One stage after another is succession. Well, there are two major categories of succession: primary succession and secondary succession. Primary succession is what happens after the worst kind of disturbances, the most severe, I should say, not worst, the most severe type of disturbances. Secondary succession happens after a less severe. Well, this fire looks like it was pretty severe, right? In the picture, in the photograph, it doesn't look like anything's alive. Of course, that's not true. These plants have been killed, and the animals that lived on them were either killed or displaced. But there are still trillions of living things here, right? What am I talking about? The bacteria in the soil. And also some seeds in the soil, by the way. So I mentioned soil because that is the actual thing that matters in the determination as to whether succession is primary or secondary. In secondary succession, the soil remains, even though it might have been a very severe disturbance, there still is soil. And therefore, you don't have to start from square one. You don't have to create soil. It's still there. And speaking of the seeds, remember when I was first talking about seeds, I said that some of them live as seeds for decades and maybe even 1,000 years, still alive, quiescent basically, waiting for their cue. For some seeds, they'll sprout easily. They just need water or something. That's their cue. Other seeds need a fire, actually, because that tells them it's your time to grow now. It's open sunlight above. There's no adults that are going to crowd you out. But you have to have seeds and soil for that to happen, right? So that's not as severe. As severe as this fire was, this is secondary succession. And what we see 1 year after the fire is obviously different from right after the fire. But if we go years after that, it's going to be another stage. In other words, these are not going to be the same kinds of organisms that are going to be there later on. That's what succession refers to. Each stage in succession, though, prepares the ecosystem for the next stage because of changes that have occurred. Now, primary succession occurs when the disturbance is so bad that even the soil is removed. And the best example of that happening, the easiest way for that to happen, is when glaciers move. Glaciers are so massive that they will scrape everything off to bare bedrock. And that is starting from square one. Because you can't have plant life and everything that that involves soil unless you first have soil. That takes its own kind of organisms and a long time before that even before you even get soil. If you think about, you know, when you grab soil, it's a complex mixture of stuff, right? Including little pieces of rock. So in terms of life, it shouldn't surprise you what the very first things that can live any given place that is denuded, what would be the first things that could live? Bacteria, the things that live anywhere there is life, right? Bacteria and other microorganisms. What do you see growing on bare rock when you go out hiking that we talked about? You do see some moss, but moss are actually would require a little bit of soil. The things living directly on the rocks, those colored spots, are lichens. Which, remember, is not a single organism. A lichen is a symbiotic relationship that involves two different species. One of them is a fungus, and the other is a microscopic photosynthesizer, which could be either a bacterium, photosynthetic bacterium, or an alga. And they can grow right on bare rock because they help each other, right? You have a producer and a consumer, both. And little by little, they will speed up the breakdown of that rock. Weather itself helps, but the growing of the lichens also does. Smaller and smaller pieces, you start building up chunks. And since they are alive, they're producing organic material. That's an important part of soil. It takes a long time, but eventually you get a buildup of organic material that we call soil. And then plants can start living in there, and they're the producers, and then other things can come in later. That's succession. We see an example of this in slide 19. This is primary succession because what's causing this disturbance is the glacier. Well, we can see different dates on this, referring to different years at which when the glacier front, where the glacier actually existed at the time, was. And so the glacier is receding. And as it does so, it's leaving behind just bare rock. Well, when the glacier was here in 1760, that was a while ago, right? It was bare rock then. It's no longer. Because all of these stages have been gone through. There's four stages shown here. So the pioneer stage, which is earliest one here, that's what things look like right now, right by the glacier. It's just left that place bare recently. But this place listed as 1760 looked like that originally, and then went through these stages and looks like this now, which means that this place, pioneer stage, will eventually look like the spruce stage if everything goes well. So it's a different set of organisms in each stage, and that's why we call it succession, one after another. Well, it's ecologically interesting because each stage features a different set of overall organisms. And it's also ecologically interesting because the set of organisms that live in one stage couldn't have lived there unless that place was prepared by the ones that lived in the previous stage. Okay, now the remaining slides are kind of varied in their topics. In slide 20, we're looking at another example of disturbance. The ones that we just looked at, the fire and the glacier, those are natural disturbances. There are natural disturbances, and there are also human-caused disturbances. And more human-caused disturbances are doing their damage. Here's a good example of human-caused disturbance. We're looking at the floor of the ocean before and after. Same shot, basically. But the event that was before and after is trawling. Trawling is a kind of fishing that instead of using rod and reel, you use huge nets, unimaginably huge nets in nowadays, that they just drag. And so unlike traditional fishing where you're searching for a specific species, in trawling you just collect anything that goes in the net. And whether you want it or not, it's going to be dragged in. And so obviously this is a major disturbance. The ocean is a big place, which is why we've been doing it. Seemingly infinite, but it's definitely not infinite. And the areas that are becoming denuded on the ocean floor by trawling, you know, are the size of states, which obviously that can't continue indefinitely. It's either we're going to have to come to our senses or we're going to go extinct. Either way, it's going to stop happening. 21. This is a kind of a non-surprising graph. Vertebrate species richness. So once again, this is a one type of biodiversity, right? On the y-axis versus potential evapotranspiration. Well, we've talked about transpiration. What was that? What is transpiration? You're not allowed to forget the plant unit, even though the test is over. Transpiration refers to the continuous movement of water from the soil solution into the roots, up through the plant, and then evaporating out. Right? That's transpiration. Evapotranspiration includes transpiration, but the evapo part means you're also including water that's just directly evaporating from the soil, not going through a plant, in other words. They both happen, right? And so if you measure both of them, you're measuring effectively an indication of the overall dampness of the place. And that's why I say this really shouldn't surprise you here. What this shows you is that in wetter places on land, you have greater biodiversity. And what is the most biodiverse place on land? Places? The biomes that have the greatest biodiversity? Tropical rainforests, which rains every day, right? So it just points out the importance of water as a resource. Everything needs it, right? So the more there is, the more there can be, the more biodiversity there can be. 22, different kind of graph here. For one thing, this is a log graph. Both the y and the x axis are logarithms. That means that each tick mark is actually 10 times bigger than the one to the left or below it. The reason they do that is simply because if you did this as a linear scale, a traditional kind of graph, they would be really spread out. By taking the log, you just compress the points into a smaller space, but they still have the same relationship with each other. Okay, but anyway, this kind of looks like a random cloud of points. They're obviously not perfectly linear, but it's not random. There is a linear trend that you can draw a line of best fit to, which is what the red line is. What's being graphed, as you see here, is once again biodiversity, in this case plant species, number of plant species, versus area of island. So this illustrates what's called the island effect. But island here doesn't necessarily mean what you probably have in mind as an island. Traditionally, an island is a piece of land surrounded by water, right? And that's an example of an island, of an ecological island. But ecological island really just means any place that is surrounded by something that's different from it. So an oasis in the middle of a desert, for instance, would be an island because it's not like the surrounding desert. Doesn't have to be surrounded by water. The island effect says that the smaller the island is, and that means real island or just ecological island, the smaller that place is that things are living in, the less biodiversity you have. And these real data show that. What's happening is that if you are making an island smaller and smaller, it puts greater pressure on the things that are living there to occupy their own niches. Right? Because you're just crowding them together too much, basically. You're forcing them to have greater and greater overlap in their niches. And that causes more competition, and some die out, biodiversity goes down. I guess there's only a couple of slides left. These are just pictures to show you what kinds of things real ecologists do as for a living. There's all kinds of things that ecologists do, by the way. Anything that involves interactions is ecology. But sometimes ecologists work with trying to figure out things that have direct impact on human health. Now, there's plenty of ecologists that are never concerned with human health, really. They're just pure ecologists. But part of ecology is also our interaction with everything, right? And so this is an example of someone studying Lyme disease, which turns out to be that we got that pretty wrong. Lyme disease is not caused by animals. It's caused by a microscopic organism, but animals carry fleas, and fleas carry the microorganism that causes Lyme disease. Well, we were blaming it on totally wrong kind of mammal carrying these fleas. At first, we spent a lot of money vaccinating them in the wild so that it would bring down their numbers. Didn't really affect the Lyme disease at all until we realized, well, it's totally different mammal. Well, we wouldn't have noticed that without ecologists working. But it's just an example. And this one, which is the last slide, I think, 24, this ecologist is up somewhere studying birds that are responsible for spreading things like avian flu, which obviously avian flu is going to affect birds, but it's also a thing that can be transmitted to humans as well. It used to be a big story in the news. Haven't heard about it too much lately. Anyway, it's all ecological examples, and that is the chapter.